From the Community Broadcast Center on Pittsburgh's South Side, this is a special community forum as part of 90.5 WESA's Life of Learning initiative. Our focus: what should the future learning education system look like to be as effective as possible for this region's young people? I'm your host, Paul Guggenheimer, and joining our audience at the Community Broadcast Center on the South Side is a distinguished panel of experts. Dr. Linda Hippert, Executive Director for the Allegheny Intermediate Unit. She began her career as a math teacher and served as a principal for 5 years prior to joining the AIU. She was the superintendent of the South Fayette School District for 13 years. Dr. Olga Welch, Dean of the School of Education at Duquesne University. She is a member of the Board of Directors of the Pittsburgh Promise, as well as Communities in Schools. Patrick Dowd, Executive Director of Allies for Children, a child advocacy organization that partners with various groups on priority issues for children, including education. A former history teacher, he served for 5 years on the Pittsburgh City Council after serving 4 years on the Pittsburgh Board of Education. Michelle King, a teacher at the Environmental Charter School. Prior to that, she taught in the Mount Lebanon School District for 15 years. And Dr. Wendell McConaughey, director of the Falk Laboratory School at the University of Pittsburgh. He started his career as a teacher and principal in Nebraska. He has been the director of the laboratory schools at the University of Northern Iowa and Louisiana State University and principal of the University of Chicago Laboratory High School. Shortly, we'll be taking questions from our studio audience. But first, my first question for all of the panelists. With the understanding that public, private, and charter schools can have different approaches to educating their students, I'd like each of you to assess the current overall system, strengths, and weaknesses. And why don't we go straight down the line, starting with Patrick Dowd.
So if we're talking about the Pittsburgh system and we were to look at the schools that we have in our region, I'd say that we have on the positive side, we have a robust collection of schools on the public side in the Pittsburgh schools. We have a small number of charters, and we have a number of high-performing charters in that population. We also have some nice non-public schools that offer a variety of choice for families inside of our community. So I think that as a parent, as a community member, we can be proud of the fact that we have a number of high-performing schools of a variety. I think we would all agree, though, that we have some challenges to deal with as far as making sure that all children have access to quality education in any of those schools. And so that's, I'd say that's something that we need to be working on. So I'll leave it at that.
Dr. Linda Hippert.
Thank you. I think when we look at education in general, our strengths are the educators who have chosen this profession. I believe our teachers, our administrators, and all are very committed to the education of children and really doing what is right and best for children. I think our challenges are that we struggle with finding the appropriate programs, the appropriate amounts of dollars and allocation of dollars and really deciding what is the best thing for children. And a weakness in our system is that we tend to do one size fits all. And we are dealing with human beings and they are very different. So our approaches to educating children also have to be different.
Michelle King.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I think I would speak to the challenge. I taught at a public, well-known public district, southwestern Pennsylvania, and by choice came to a charter school to really push the discussions on education. I think what we need is a new metaphor for learning and education. And we are not competitors, but we are collaborators in the well-being of all the children in Pittsburgh. And so to think about public school, private schools, charter schools as all collaborative members in the well-being of the city, if we really think about the health of the city as really tied to the well-being of its children, we can think differently about how to solve the problems. It's really, we have a, as Linda talked about, the, you know, the abundance of excellent educators, the abundance of children and families that are really committed to education. If we think about that, that's a different way than thinking about scarcity and what we don't have. So really, what I would say is really pushing, and that's why I came to the charter school, to environmental charter school, was to push this idea of collaborative ways in which we educate all children within, you know, Pittsburgh and the surrounding areas.
Dr. Wendell McConaughey.
I would agree that we have a really strong network of both public and private schools. And I would agree with Michelle in that I think the key to it is effective teaching. I do something with my university classes, and I ask them to shut their eyes and think of the best teacher they ever had. And three things happen. First of all, everyone thinks of someone. No one gets to be a master's degree level and say, I can't think of one good teacher I had. The second thing that happens, it's never a university professor. It's always an elementary teacher, sometimes a middle school teacher, but usually elementary. And third, I say, what were the things that made that teacher really good? And they start naming characteristics: caring, worried about me, saw me as an individual. And we realize that not one of those things are things we teach in the School of Education. I think we've done a great job of saying these are the standards and benchmarks that we need to address, but I think we've moved away from the local control of school districts and put it more at the state and even the national level. And I think the key to successful schools is a better job of preparing teachers and giving them the latitude to teach to their strengths.
Dr. Olga Welsh.
I think until we as a community become outraged that all our children are not being educated, then we will continue to pass it off as something that the educators need to deal with, something that the state politicians need to deal with, something that the community, civic and community organizations need to deal with. These are our children, all of them. The homeless children are our children. The children of poverty are our children. And until we as citizens become outraged that we are not providing equity and equality in terms of educational opportunity, then we will continue to be interrogating methodologies and interrogating structures and forgetting about the fact that the children are what we need to pay attention to.
Before we discuss what the future system, what the future approach should include, let's examine how we got where we are today, how learning evolved to meeting changing needs and expectation. Linda Hippert, do you want to start with that one? And I'd like you to expound perhaps on what you were talking about earlier with this getting locked into a one-size-fits-all approach to education.
So just looking back on education itself, really when we reflect on how public education really got started, first of all, we began by the hunter-gatherer area, where work and play were essentially the same thing. And student or children were just helping with their families. And then they moved to the agrarian age, where students, children, were actually working with families. But when that became too much for them to handle, that's really when our first public schools were formed. Multi-age public schools, oftentimes older children were teaching younger children. And as we think about how education itself evolved, we look at the industrial age. And oftentimes when we talk about, when I talk about one size fits all, we are still very much, even though with some changes, in this industrial age era, of education, where the whole system was designed to select and to sort. Any of you in the audience is pretty young, but if any of you recall, you know, we sat in rows and everyone learned the same thing at the same time, at the same pace. And really, education was producing the workers for society. And depending on what level you were and how quickly you learned and how much you learned, you were placed into particular jobs. Many people dropped out of school at that time and went to work, while others began and became educated, more educated, and moved into other positions. But now our world is different. We know education is very different. At that time, when you think of the industrial age, we can simplify what it looked like. It was school, work, in retirement. And most people stayed in the same job. They never left that job, or at least they never left that company. And so they pretty much could plan out what they did. But now we know things have changed dramatically. We know that what is being taught in school at the time we teach it often becomes obsolete by the time the children leave our schools. We also know that the U.S. Department of Labor estimates that today's learners will have 10 to 14 different jobs by the age of 38, very different than in the past. And we also, to kind of borrow a quote from Margaret Mead, we are preparing students in our schools for jobs that do not yet exist. And we are actually using technology right now that has not yet been invented, and we will use technology, in order to solve problems that we don't even know will exist. So that's the challenge we have in our public education system today. It cannot be a one-size-fits-all. Everyone needs to be educated. We know that two-thirds of the jobs that will be available, that currently are available, require more than a high school education. So we cannot afford to have dropouts and students drop out of school. We have to make sure that every child is able to learn and able to become a productive citizen.
Would someone else like to chime in? Dr. Ogle-Welch, I saw you nodding your head when Dr. Hibbert was talking about we are teaching children and preparing them for jobs that no longer exist. What are your thoughts? What concerns do you have about that?
I think that learning, we've lost the love of learning in schools and the ability to use that love of learning to problem solve. And by that I mean that you get taught how to deal with problems that you've never encountered before. And so you are engaged with learning and you have enough background information. Things like how to put together a cogent argument and how to make your point and how to do so where you're the point is not to yell down your opponent or to beat your opponent with an ideological argument, but rather to defend and talk about your own position and engage the other human being in a conversation about problem and how we can both come to that problem from our different places and begin to solve it. The other thing that I wanted to say was how I'm delighted to be on a panel with other people who, like myself, have been principals and also teachers in classrooms prior to entering either the political arena or entering higher education. So I think that the important thing is the engagement. And then when you're talking about the jobs, if you teach people how to think, if you teach people to be excited about learning, if you teach people how to ask good questions, if you teach people that they don't know what they don't know, and therefore there is a humility in learning, I think that's when you prepare them for almost any position they want to enter.
Patrick Dowd, quick comment before we move on.
Just to follow up on the two previous comments, I mean, I think 100 years ago, right, the assembly line was invented, and the idea of work was that it was done in a particular place. And I think also what Dr. Hibbert is also sort of pointing to is this idea not only of the sort of one-size-fits-all model, but it's also the one space for learning. And that's also something that we have to think about over time. We currently put a lot of emphasis on the building and the place where learning takes place, and we assume that that is the place, and there's almost a monopoly on learning, when we know in reality, especially in the world that we live in today, that is not the case. There's learning taking place in all sorts of other spaces besides what we call the school, the building in which people go to get educated.
Okay, so we've shared some insight into how we arrived at this educational crossroads, if you will. So, panel, you can have a blank slate if you wish. But what successful methods, techniques would you keep? What would you replace or tweak to have a process that will better prepare students for the workplace and their futures? And I'm going to start with Michelle King on that one.
Well, I want to jump a little bit to that previous question to set up what I would say,
sure.
Which is school, it used to have a monopoly on information, mm-hmm. and on transmission of information. And it used to be that you had to come to school, you had to come to a place to get knowledge. And yet now with just the proliferation of information and access to technology, we no longer have the cornerstone on information. So that changes fundamentally what school does. And now we need to ask ourselves, what is the purpose of education? Do we go all the way back to Aristotle and what he talked about in Nicomedean Ethics, which he says it's about eudaimonia, about the flourishing of human life? And come back to what Ogle said, to really to inspire and to have this sense of wonder. So then then learning is more than just place, right? If we think about it as an ecology, it's about home, it's about library, it's about after-school programs, in-school programs. What I would say is you got to have that, like, kids, they love learning. It's a powerful thing. And can you create the conditions for those kind of things? One way that we've done it in our class was to do through games and actually design a game in which we try to answer a question that does not have, that cannot be Googled. So right there, you start with something that you cannot immediately look up, but you have to wrestle with the intellectual, the moral, the ethical issues. And I think that's where learning is. You want learning to leave your space and go beyond it and come back and have kids really be excited. So I think that I got a little crazy. But
well, you're trying to find that new metaphor for learning.
But I think it has to have that kind of power where you want to go out and tell somebody what you've learned or what you're puzzled about.
Dr. McConaughey.
I think, first of all, that we can't lose sight of the fact, and I agree with Linda's assessment of one size fits all is what education has moved toward. We've done it to ourselves. I've been able to work all over the world. And when I started doing that work, and even in the early 90s, it was a situation where we were one of the few countries that didn't have a central ministry of education. The responsibility for school was local control. And even though it was one size fits all, let's say, for the city of Pittsburgh, how we educated people in Pittsburgh was different from how we educated people in Cranberry, because we had people that controlled it locally. Schools have a reason for existing, and it's not the same reason. Some is to prepare a workforce. Some is preparation for college. Some is social escalator, whatever it may be. But the best people to decide that are the individual cities and how their children. Do you have to differentiate even between that? Absolutely. But let's start with the standpoint that the reason that people are being prepared in a particular area is going to differ from Nebraska to Pittsburgh to wherever it may be. We now have moved to a situation where every state in the union has a series of state standards that all schools must adhere to. We're taking more and more control away from the teacher on how to meet those standards. We're a short step away from what other European countries are, where they stop preparing students in May in order to take the high-stakes test in July, and we don't want to move to that point. I think we really need to look at having, as Michelle said, not only the control for the individual schools within the community, but even further within the individual school. Don't teach kids facts. Teach them the right questions to ask, and I think it will help a lot.
Do we know what the workplace of the future looks like? How can you know what skills and knowledge are needed? I'll toss that up to anybody on the panel. Stump the panel. Oh, great. Okay. So Patrick, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I don't think we can predict that exactly, but I think it'd be pretty obvious that collaboration is going to be a critical component for what the workplace will look like. Just think of the way that we do our work today. The software technology and the way that leads us. So I would say that as we think about that workspace and we think about what we want to produce inside of our society, we're going to want to find a way to teach children, teach youth, teach young adults to do more collaborative work. And I think to Michelle's point, to see the transmission of facts as sort of the foundation or just an aspect of education, and really to start to see that educator and the student or the group of students and as a team and a crew of collaborators attempting to gain knowledge beyond just mastery of simple facts, but really to integrate what they've learned. So I would point to collaboration among other things.
Olga Welch.
I want to see students make connections between what they learn in school and what they experience in life. I want them to be able to problem solve, and I want them to have the knowledge to be able to approach a problem or an issue with a basis, yes, but also with the ability to go beyond what is obvious. I want them to be able to have the human relation skills that are necessary to listen from to different groups that they've never interacted with before. And I want them to have the cultural understanding to recognize that wherever they come from is not the only place that one can gain knowledge. And the way that one gains knowledge is not always the same way we do so in Western cultures or in Western civilizations.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Children come with curriculum. They come with their own curriculum and way of how they've come through the world. I also think about empathy, the capacity to understand others from their perspective and to think about interconnections. How are we interconnected? How are we, you know, when we design, say, a business, what are the implications for a city? So to even get kids to think about the implications or future of their choices, like I designed as a great tool to use as Minecraft. Don't I have any Minecraft love out there? Yeah. Minecraft, that's right. It's a great building tool. It's like virtual Legos. You go into space, you could do like Pittsburgh 3.0, have kids redesign Pittsburgh so that it has certain values that we want to have, collaboration, right? Cooperation, all kinds of things. So really getting them to wrestle with interesting things. But I definitely think all of the points that you talked to, those are going to be, however in life, are going to be lifelong skills to have.
Dr. Hippert.
And then we have the reality of the system in which we are working that is measured by a single test in most cases. And so teachers who are now evaluated on that single test, for the most part, maybe a few other criteria, administrators, schools, et cetera, and that every child really needs to be at the same place at the same time, or else we are considered failures. So I think at the same time we talk about the ideal, which I certainly agree with my colleagues, we also have to look at the realistic, what is happening in our pre-K to 12 public schools right now, and that whole issue of assessment and how we're measured.
I agree with you. Do you want us to?
Go ahead, Michelle.
I agree, but we need to ask ourselves, what are the things that are immeasurable that we value? And there are a lot of times where we reduce things to a single number. And so right now that becomes reading and math and in English that begins to eliminate the arts. So we're saying if there's no empirical value for the arts, then we shouldn't have it in schools. If there's no empirical value for history because it doesn't have a number, should we not have it in schools? So I ask ourselves, when we look at and reflect on our lives, do we go back and talk about the scores that we got in school? Or do we begin to talk about the more things like relationships, meaningful lives? And I'm not dismissing, but I think we have to ask ourselves, we have pigeonholed ourselves into this place by only looking at these certain scores and saying then we have value.
So that it's not just about the doing of the thing that you're learning, but why am I learning this and how can I apply it and what happens after I do?
What's happening on the other 100 and something days of learning?
I would argue that what Dr. McConaughey said earlier is what those students in his class are reflecting on when they talk about the teacher who made the difference. The teacher who made the difference, I would argue, was the teacher who stretched them places they'd never been before, who demanded excellence from them, but not in a one-size-fits-all way, but saying, I know that you have within you the ability to do X, Y, or Z, and I want to see you demonstrate it. Those are the characteristics that we're talking about, but not being, as Dr. Hippert has said, being Pollyanna about the systems in which we operate and what we need to do to dismantle some of them so that we can get back to the kind of values we care about.
Patrick Dowd, you wanted to make a point.
I think we want to keep in mind, because all these are very important points, I think there are two things happening in our society at the same time. We are attempting to reform an existing system. We have a current system that has to meet the needs of all children. We are trying to reform that system and make it the best as possible because we have kids who are currently in need of learning opportunities. But we are at the same time attempting to create, I think, something new, something different. And so there are two things happening at the same time, and we just have to recognize that we're trying to do that.
Dr. McConaughey?
Yeah, I would say I agree with that statement. However, it's one thing to have a goal or a standard, a benchmark that you expect the class to attain, and then give the teacher the latitude to choose the method and the materials on how they're going to reach that goal. If we have a requirement for a goal, that's one thing. If we have a specific requirement on how you must attain that goal, that's something else. I believe philosophically that you give the teachers the ability to teach to their strengths. You can have the same goals in language arts with one second grade teacher using Shakespeare and somebody else using The Hobbit. It's still able to reach those goals, but you're allowing the teacher to teach to the strength. I think more and more as we put these tests in place, we're not only saying that this is what you need to do, but this is how you need to do it. And I think we're taking the artistry out of teaching. I think teachers are artists and craftsmen, and I think we're turning them into technicians.
You're listening to a special WESA Life of Learning Community Forum on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and our guests are Dr. Linda Hippert, Executive Director of the Allegheny Intermediate Unit, Dr. Olga Welch, Dean of the School of Education at Duquesne, Patrick Dowd, Executive Director of Allies for Children, Michelle King, teacher at the Environmental Charter School, and Dr. Wendell McConaughey, Director of the Falk Laboratory School at Pitt. We have a studio audience that would like to ask some questions, and let's go to our audience right now.
My name is Medina Jackson. I am the Community Outreach Coordinator for Ready Freddy Pathways to Kindergarten Success. We're out of the University of Pittsburgh's Office of Child Development. And I'll direct my question to the whole panel since all of you have had teaching experience and some of you are currently teaching and training future teachers. how much preparation are teachers in training receiving around parent engagement and teaching within high poverty and trauma communities? And do you feel that preparation is adequate?
No. We are not. And I think it is because we have really ourselves not engaged with those communities enough. We don't know what we don't know, and therefore we are unable to design the curricula for our teachers that they need in order to be successful with those communities. And I say that the other piece of that, the caveat to that, is that I think that schools and colleges of education are grappling much more now and partnering with those communities to adjust and revise our curricula and the ways in which we prepare our students. That's the knowledge piece. The other piece is much more complicated but equally important, and that is the dispositions piece. That is, you do not go into those communities and say, in effect, oh, welcome me to your community. Now I think I'll redecorate. What you do is you go into those communities respectfully, and what you do is you ask questions about what is the best way, what are we not doing, what do we do well, what do we need to do better, and then help us to revise our curriculum.
Dr. McConaughey, are the expectations of teachers changing? Teachers were looked upon as the end source, the repository of information for students, and now are they more of a conduit of information, helping students find the information?
Yeah, to answer that part, I think that's absolutely correct and probably should be moving in that direction. It's the sage on the stage doesn't even work at the university level anymore. It's a situation where there are so many ways students can garner information that in many times it's better for the teacher to be a facilitator. As Michelle said, put those tools in front of them that allow them to work. But to the previous question, I think the university, and you know the Pitt program better than I do, but it's a situation that I think the university really has dropped the ball in a number of ways. When you talk about parent interaction, it's sometimes an option on whether or not the student teacher or the intern is even present at teacher conferences. For example, it's possible for a student teacher to go through an entire semester and maybe never participate in a parent teacher conference. It's a situation where the sequence of courses, like lesson planning, doesn't necessarily correspond, and I'm speaking of Pitt, not of Duquesne, things don't necessarily correspond to the sequence when you go out. You may learn to do lesson plans in October, and you're already in the school in September. So it's a situation where instructional planning, the ability to develop, very few teachers are taught how to build their own curriculum. They're taught to work with the Basel series, they're taught to work with other texts, but to do the kinds of things that Michelle is able to do, it's learned over the long haul. These are things she's done that have been successful. So I think the university could do a much better job as far as integrating the teacher into the parent community, and I think they could do a much better job as far as making them more a facilitator of learning than an absolute purveyor of information.
Let's take another question from the audience.
Yes, my name is Gershon, and I'm a retired teacher from California for 25 years, graduate from the University of Pittsburgh, graduate school in child development, child care at Falk, and I was also on the race and desegregation committee back in the day. And I have what I hope is a very evocative statement for everybody. And if you'll bear with me, it's a short quote. "We must never forget that World War II and the Holocaust were technologically sophisticated arms buildup and aggressive military reflected the schemes of highly educated people, proficient policymakers, and striving efficient achievers at the top of the game, people seeking world domination and power for its own sake. Was a global conflagration visiting unspeakable suffering everywhere. It was a murderous conflict in which highly trained engineers built gas chambers to exterminate innocent people, and physicians exterminated and poisoned children. World War II taught us that education must be directed toward humane ends because, as humans, we are capable of great evil." And that's a quote from Chaim Gnat, the educator. So my point is that the approach to education that has been talked about, I believe, should be a human rights-based approach to education. It deals with what education is about. For myself personally, I don't think education is about jobs. It's about how to conduct yourself as a human being. It's about what it means to be meaningful in the world. You know, the way we have it right now, everything's being privatized, and everything is modeled upon a market-based value system, which is outcomes and numbers. Now, to the councilman, I don't know if you were on the council in April of 2011, were you? Well, then you're one of the council members who signed the bill, the proclamation declaration, making Pittsburgh the fifth human rights city in the United States. Is that correct?
That's right.
And this proclamation says, if I may, that Pittsburgh as a human rights city is one whose residents and local authorities, through ongoing discussions and creative exchanges of ideas, come to understandings that human rights, when they are widely known as a way of life, assist in identifying the issues and inform the actions in community for meaningful, positive economic and social change. So I say to you that that is the direction that I think education should be going. And
do you, excuse
dean,
me, sir, but I apologize for interrupting, but do you have a question, sir?
I would invite that you, in graduate school, make it a human rights education course just as an introduction so educators know what it is that's being talked about when we say human rights education.
Your assumption is that it's not happening at Duquesne. So let me make clear that at Duquesne, we pay a great deal of attention because for us, education is a moral imperative and a social justice right. And we get that because the spirit and fathers who founded Duquesne believed in social justice. And so it's central to everything that we do in terms of our preparation. Are we perfect? Absolutely not. Do we need to continue to grow? Absolutely. So I appreciate that you recognize that human rights are important in the educational process and in the preparation of teachers.
And I'll jump in here too. I want to just sort of give a little pushback on this idea of privatization in the arena of education and outcomes based issues. Focus. First of all, I think we're not seeing a privatization of education in this region. We have a number of charter schools, but they are not for-profit charter schools, most of them. And in fact, Pittsburgh is very low as far as the number of charters that it has relative to other urban centers. So that would, and I don't think of charters as privatized entities necessarily. Second of all, as far as outcomes-based education focus, the concerns that you have about results, let's talk about where that came from. I think we've sort of lost track of that. And I know there are a tremendous number of issues. I have five kids who are going through testing. I deal with this at the dinner table on a regular basis. But the reality is that we want to find a way to make sure that our systems are performing for children. And we have to find a way. We're spending, you know, millions and tens of millions and, you know, half a billion here and half a billion there on public education. And we want to make sure that that system is effective for the children who are going through it. So I think there's a balance to be struck. It's not, you know, maybe the pendulum has swung to a particular point at this moment, but there is a balance to be struck, and accountability is an important part of how we want to see education, no matter what the system looks like, no matter what time period we're in. I want to know that when my kids go to school and your kids go to school and any child goes to school, that they have equal access and high-quality opportunities to advance.
Let's take a question from the audience.
My name is Archana Bandy, and I'm a mother and a physician. So I'm a teacher at home, and I'm a teacher at work.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to Paul's question. How our future workplaces are going to look like. And we can't imagine, actually, they're going to be much different than what they are today. So we can talk about our assessment, Common Core standards, teacher quality, but we need to realize that we need to take our education to a level where these kids, their wonder of learning stays, and they become from learners to innovators. And I think we have talked a lot about everything other than kids so far. We need to find out, we can't fit all the kids in one box. We need to know in one classroom how a teacher can individualize and still address the whole group of kids that she has, or he has. So how do you think our future classrooms, which cannot happen tomorrow, it has to happen yesterday.
Yeah. Let's go to Dr. Hippert.
The delivery of instruction needs to change for children because they are different, and we do know now that they learn very differently. And I think it's important for us to realize that in our classrooms today, in our 42 schools in Allegheny County, which I can address, they are trying new delivery methods, but we're not there yet. We are in a time, Clayton Christensen calls it disruptive innovation. Technology is here to stay. And technology is not the answer to teaching students, but it is a tremendous tool that we have that keeps improving all the time to personalize learning so that we can take children from where they are and have them grow and learn. There is a foundation. I do believe that it's important that we have standards. Children today don't stay in their neighborhoods and work. We hope as many as possible stay in the Pittsburgh region, but they move from place to place, and they are competing with children internationally for jobs. So we have to make sure that there is a certain level of foundation that they have. But we also, through our systems, through our delivery systems, and that's why I talk about our system right now is antiquated, but we have to find ways to improve that to address the needs of all learners.
If the process includes teaching and preparing kids for jobs that currently do not exist, then jobs, it would logically seem, would need to be there when they graduate. Is closer collaboration with employers needed, better foresight about what might be available 5 or 10 years into the future? What needs to happen here?
Well, we are working very closely with the workforce in Pittsburgh, and I think one of the things that is important and how children are different today is we need to connect them with the workforce. One, so employers really understand schools, and we've had some opportunities here in the Pittsburgh region to do that, but also so that students are able to establish some goals for their future where they see in real life what possibilities exist. And they may not be the exact jobs, but it helps them to love learning and see that there's a purpose of their learning that leads to a future in perhaps one of these areas of employment.
Michelle King.
Yes, sir.
You were wanting to jump in on that. I can
a couple of
thoughts.
Points. Yeah, well, how should I say this? So I think I'll start with this. Jesse Schell, who's a game designer in Pittsburgh, well-known, excellent guy, he said, the next war is the war for our attention. And we have so many competing things that are competing for our attention. And so by that token, you have to really design learning experiences that are engaging and that are going to extend to multiple places. And one way we've done that, my colleague Nick Kaczmarek and I designed a game called Colonial Thrive, in which you have a giant physical game board that teaches about colonization of the New World. Five European nations, five Native American nations. Kids represent that. Their goal is to thrive. We built in, they're learning about economics, they're learning about religion, social systems, all kinds of things. And one of the mechanics that we put in the game was a failure to thrive line. That the only way to win the game is if all nations were above the failure to thrive line. You learned about collaboration, you learned about making treaties, you learned about economic systems, and you learned about the implications of your decisions. It was something that is embedded in that was failure. Do we, you know, I think that's something in life that we have to learn, dealing with failure, recovering, resiliency. It was something that extended across class, so writing was embedded in that. Kids wrote the history from one class to the next. Writing was not something that was a requirement. It was essential because you needed to communicate your history to the next group. So can we create learning experiences that don't exist just in history or just in math or just in language arts or just in the arts, but in fact these complex learning experiences that extend in all places? Why can't we have at times, like if kids were to redesign cities in Minecraft and invite the council over to review their plans, and so that we have this kind of merging of both that school and learning doesn't exist just in physical places, but in all our places. And the other thing is we constantly are looking for employers, but we know that the majority of jobs are produced by small business owners. So why isn't there this entrepreneurial and innovative energy that it goes into kids creating things? Just as a question.
Go ahead, Patrick.
So just thinking about that for a second, I lost my thought.
So I'll just jump in and say that there's more people, there's more of these things happening in our schools than I think sometimes people think. I see it firsthand with 42 districts, all of whom are engaging in creative activities and interdisciplinary activities with children. Michelle talked so much about gaming. We have two of our 42 schools that have been accepted to national recognition for what is happening in their area. So we're very fortunate in our Pittsburgh region to have the support of foundations to start innovative and creative programs in the school. We've partnered with the Institute of Play out of New York. Teachers are learning professional development in order to implement gaming in their classrooms. Many of you have read about Elizabeth Forward School District that has started this, not a wealthy school district by any means, that has an entire program that engages students. And when you talk to them, they know, and they will tell you, the students will tell you how much they're learning and in a different way and how appreciative they are of that.
Patrick, did that thought come back to
you? Yeah, I was thinking about the game. I was excited about the game. And so, seriously, I think if you think about where learning takes place, your very question implied that there was a building and that things were taking place inside that building, and then people needed to leave that building and go out and do certain things and build connections. And I think as we sort of look forward and think about all the things that the current educators are talking about, there is going to be no more central location. I mean, maybe it's an exaggeration, but let's say there is no school building anymore, and that learning actually is decentralized from a physical plant. That's probably never going to happen, but to see the building where learning takes place as less primary, and to be able to see these sorts of connections as more central, as more important to what's taking place. So learning can take place in a library. People can go and learn more about information and how to process information at the Carnegie Library than perhaps they can anywhere else. So why not legitimate the learning that takes place there and see that as part of a diploma that one would earn? Or working at the film, the Arts Center, the Center for the Arts on Fifth Avenue, and seeing that as a place, as an additional place, not the only place, but an additional place where one can begin to build those credits. And the point is to start to build out from there to employers and to other parts of our community.
And well, have as stakeholders the entire community.
Right.
so that the entire community views the learning of its children as its primary responsibility. So wherever you are, you are connected to the learning of the children that come within your sphere or the youth. And so then the problem solving that starts in perhaps a physical space moves out into a community, because eventually what's going to happen is that you're going to have a community of educated citizens. And citizenry doesn't happen in a classroom. Citizenry happens when you grapple with real problems in communities, which means we have to come together as stakeholders and figure out how to make those connections.
Well, one of the things that we're hearing is that the traditional educational model might, as far as attending school in a building, in a classroom, in a physical space, that it might be flipped, and that what you might have in the future is students who are learning online. The lessons are happening. They could be at home on a computer, and then they come to school for the homework. Dr. McConaughey, what have you tapped into that idea, and what are some of your thoughts on
that? I've heard of the idea and totally rejected it.
How come?
I think the model needs to be expanded the way it is right now. I'm not sure that the concept of doing your homework at school and your schoolwork at home necessarily is the direction that I would see going.
What about the idea that Patrick brought up about the physical space?
I think absolutely. And it used to be the situation that the field trips you took were in May when you were done teaching and wanted to go out and do things. But it's a situation now that, I mean, we're lucky. We're on the University of Pittsburgh campus. A large majority of our program takes place in the Carnegie, takes place on the university campus. We use the whole thing. But even within the classroom, during the last election, In our language arts teacher's class in middle school, they were using notebooks and using a wireless system and looking at comparative, really looking at the issue of whether or not a particular media outlet favored a particular candidate. And there's software that you can do to assess that. So it's a situation where you're seeing a lot of collaboration between technology and the traditional teaching. Back to the earlier question that you had asked about the classroom, in an average third grade classroom, you're going to have 5 years range in both reading and math ability. How do you teach? You can't teach to the middle. You can't teach to the lower end. So we need to do a better job preparing our teachers on how to individualize instruction within a classroom of 25 or 30 students. I observed a third grade classroom the other day, and they were learning to write equations. And all of them were working, but they were working at three different levels. In one case, the teacher had equations and said, mirror what it was that I just put up and do it with symbols. In another case, it was take what I put up but do it in a slightly different way. I don't want it to look like what I did. And in another case, for simplification, it was basically an empty page. Everybody was working on equations. Everybody was working on math. Michelle didn't know what I was working on. She didn't know what I was working on. We were both engaged, but at three different levels. So she was actually covering three different levels at that point. Take something like robotics and teach writing with it. The same sort of verbiage that you need to get a robot to go out, turn, kick a ball, and come back is the same thing in creative writing you need to lead your reader to the place you want them to go. And so we're looking at things like using robotics in language arts, where you would never think of it before. So I think it's not a case of flipping the whole system on end. It's a case of doing a better job of the integration that Michelle talks about, whether it's gaming, whether it's mechanics, whatever it may be. But we do have to catch their attention. We're in a multimedia age of students, and we have to get their attention to teach them. But we have to also have a school where they get upset when it snows and they can't come.
Let's take another question from our audience.
Hi. Questions for everyone on the panel. But at one point, Mrs. Welch, there were two separate times, you listed off a bunch of goals that you thought people should learn in school. And the first list reminded me exactly of the goals in a philosophy class. And the second list was exactly the goals you should learn in an anthropology class. Why aren't these getting taught to high schoolers? Because I went to two high schools. I went to North Catholic and I went to Seneca Valley. Neither school offered a philosophy class or an anthropology class.
I think the integration is what is missing. And I think that I maybe be dating myself. But one of the things that I learned, and I learned it in college, but I had it throughout my educational experience, was I had to connect. So if I was in an art history class, I had to talk about the literature, I had to talk about the philosophy, I had to talk about the political climate that produced the art.
as well as name the art and the artist. And so it gave me a holistic gestalt around learning and around how things were produced, and it didn't just come out of the air. I think that what you're talking about is integrated, and I think that's what we're trying to do in education, is to integrate the learning for our students, to help our students to make the connections and not to leave it to chance. So we may not name it philosophy, we may not name it anthropology, but the concepts allow the students to cross, to border cross between those two disciplines and make those connections.
Jump in, because I agree.
Michelle.
I think that's a very powerful point. And one of the things in our game was that you traded, you know, for sugar. Once sugar becomes a major commodity in the game, slavery comes in. And so all of a sudden, the kids begin to understand the economic implications for how slavery gets involved. So you can say, oh, yeah, I wouldn't support slavery or anything like that. But when you understand the huge amount of wealth that was generated by trainee human beings, all of a sudden things become complex. You understand the interconnections and the implications of how systems are designed. We have designed our systems. We've designed our economic and political systems. And so if you get kids in those positions where they're really wrestling with these complex issues, they begin to see the complexity and the interconnectedness. So I think those are the really powerful kind of learning experiences.
Between these two people, I'm going to agree with both of them. One of the things that in a social studies class that was a modern world history class, the course consisted of four quarters. At each quarter, they did a different edition of the New Yorker magazine. But it focused on a different set of a different period of history. So in order to do that, the students had to learn about the music, the theater, the literature, the history, the economics. They did cartoons. They did cover art. They did everything. They thought they were blowing off an entire year. What it ended up was a situation that they learned more about that period, and it included sociology. It included economics. It included philosophy. And it was still modern world history, but the teacher had the latitude to teach it the way he wanted to. And the kids were engaged. And I think getting them engaged, having them want to be at school, is the biggest battle that we face.
You're listening to a special WESA Life of Learning Community Forum on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're discussing what the future education system should include to best prepare the region's young people. Let's go back to our audience for a question.
Hello. My name is Sandra Woolley, and I'm a retired educator. I was a teacher, a principal, and professor at a state system school, and now I'm a grandparent. And my grandsons, one of them goes to public school in Pittsburgh and one to a private school because, frankly, he couldn't manage the 10 teachers that he had to deal with in the public school. And I think that was caused by the fact that teachers are trying to help kids do well on the tests. And so I would invite any of your comments about the impact of standardized testing on the public schools. Some of the teaching that you're talking about doing and what Michelle's talking about doing, I saw many teachers do that too. And I see that it's happening less often because of the standardized testing. I would just invite one other issue, and that is the opportunity gap that I believe exists between some families and children, like my own grandsons. They can do all of that you're talking about outside of school if they don't get it inside school. So I'm concerned about the opportunity for children who can't get this outside of school. Dr. Welch, you mentioned wraparound services. I think they're sorely missing for those children. And I'd be interested in your discussion of those topics.
So first of all, I think all of your comments about what schools need to do are correct. However, over years, there is so much that is now expected of our educators that they really can't do it all, whether it's add more courses to teach or take care of all the social, emotional, physical needs of children that are really stopping progress in many cases. On the other hand, I think educators are working very hard to do that. On that note, how we accomplish that
is back to a system that was built upon this industrial system, where our high school courses are still 45 minutes, and then you change class and you stop everything that you were doing and learning in math and go to an English class or go to a social studies class. It's because our system's been designed that way. We can't ignore the fact that some testing, in my opinion, my personal opinion, is good, because it allows us to measure student progress. However, our system is built on every child having to be at a certain place at a certain time, whether no matter what their background or previous experiences have been. And when they're not there, either the teacher is labeled a failure or the student is labeled a failure very early on. And none of us want to be in situations where we're learning anything, whether it's a skill, and we are always feeling as though we failed just because we're not there yet. So I think that's where we have to look at the entire system and see what is it that is right for everyone. And we have to stop looking at the element of time and instead saying, here's where we would like all children to be, but you, whether you're teacher or student or parent, are not a failure because you're not there at that time. But in order to deliver like that, we have to reconstruct our system, and I think that's what we have to look at ways to do.
Okay, so let's look at the question of what does a world-class education look like? And I'm going to toss that out to our panelists and let whoever wants to jump in first take that. Dr. Welch.
I think that the politicians and the policymakers define world-class in ways that clearly create world-class schools better fitted for that industrial age. So we continue to replicate a beautiful 19th century concept, but it's not working today. I would think that a world-class education, first of all, means that you can globally assess what the issues are that connect as well as divide you. So you talk about how the thing that intrigues me about Michelle's game is that the idea of dealing and grappling with so many of the issues that cross borders in the world. And so beginning to do that, I think that then begins to deal with the opportunity gap that you talk about. Because if it becomes a way of educating all children to see themselves as global citizens, then the problems that are occurring in the Ukraine, for example, are not just the Ukraine. They are my issues as well. And here's why, and to be able to take that apart. So world class is not passing tests. World class is not being in a pyramid of some of sorts where we try to outdo each other. World class is how do we live together as world citizens and grapple with the multiple issues that we have as citizens of that globe.
Michelle King?
Oh, I would jump on that because I think one of the things is, you know, when I often talk about, we often don't have to live with the consequences that are of our own behavior, right? I talk to the kids, we've been at war, they've been at war most of their childhood. And yet they don't live in a way that they've ever been at war, right? Kids in Afghanistan live in war. In Iraq have lived in war. But what have been the implications of our decisions? You start connecting kids to current events. You start, you know, talking about what's happening in Ukraine. You know, how do we live in a world? We all live together. We all breathe the same air, right? We all have to use, we're going to have water crisis. We have resource crisis. How is it that we work as a people and understand our interconnections? That's the powerful thing. When you start getting kids to work on the wicked problems, they shouldn't be working on problems that have no relevancy in their lives. But what are those things that we have yet to solve, right? That's where I think, I mean, and there's a great game. John Hunter has this, you know, world peace game where kids work on, fourth graders work on 50 complex problems. They have to all solve them. These are the things that kids are going to have to face. Like, imagine, how would you get kids to solve the government shutdown that we had several months ago? That's not a single problem. That's not a math problem. That's not an English problem, a history problem. That's a complex issue. What is the role of government in the 21st century?
And a world-class education would involve the students in governance structures in the schools so that they learn, they see how one operates in a political system and how one governs.
Patrick Dapp?
So I would think that and to some extent we have some elements of that system that already exists, but you would want a system where students are at the center with their educator, their teacher, as the facilitator of their learning, and that the time element that Dr. Hippert has spoken about several times is eliminated and that creativity is released in these different ways.
So one of the things that we also see beginning to happen and through technology and video conferencing in the county, all of our schools are connected and have this capability to universities, Internet too, as well as an example would be during the G20 summit that was held in Pittsburgh. Our students in the county had the opportunity to connect with students from some of the countries that were represented. So they are learning that real life experience and discussing some of the issues that may have been discussed as well. I think that's the beginning of these types of opportunities. But when you refer to world class, I think what is important for us as a country to remain at the level where we are is for students to, for parents to value education. Even if they are not able to help their children, that they value education enough to get their children to school and to provide time and space for them to learn in the evenings or do things. We have to get back to the importance of education. We as educators then in turn have to make sure that we are addressing the needs of children that make them want to come to school and make them want to learn more, whatever it is, whatever area they want to study more. And then when they leave the pre-K to 12 education, that there are great opportunities for them that are also affordable for all in order to have that post-secondary education to get the jobs that may be available and hopefully will be available to them in the future.
Let's talk about the role that technology plays in developing and implementing a learning system. How do we make sure that technology, for example, remains a tool and not a crutch? Patrick Dapp.
So, I've learned a little bit about this from my son this year, who's taught me a whole lot about Khan Academy, which isn't, I have, as a former educator, I have some hesitation about this. But the idea that somebody could log online and find an instructor for a lesson that meets their personality for that conveying of information for that particular moment, I think is an important element that we can see going forward. You're still always going to need that teacher working with the student in person, but to have those kinds of abilities, those kinds of capacities to access information that way. I also think about the platforms that we use, many of us at work, for collaboration and project management, and to start to see, in some cases we're seeing that at the university level, not so much at the secondary level, but to start to see those tools as a way to bring kids together in projects and collaboration is also an important way to see technology as a tool, not as a crutch.
Michelle King.
I think another way I think we need to think about technology is just because we can create it, should we be creating it? Yeah, some of the technologies. So like, for example, Google Glass. Well, that's awesome to have that. But then, then we have emerged of the glass hole, right? What becomes of things like privacy? When are we going to have discussions about the privacy that we give up in terms of some of the technologies? Even think about the amount of student data that gets out there. When we're using some of these programs, have we really begun to have these discussions about the implications of using some of these technologies?
So you're saying that ethics should be taught along with
absolutely in the design, because what are some of these things? There's sometimes not the intention of the creator of these technologies. So we need to think about, there's some positive aspects, like Twitter has been something. I don't think Twitter has been probably my number one professional development tool, because it allows me to connect with people from all around the country and from around the world talking about issues. I don't think that was the intent of the designer, so that was a kind of positive implication. But then we have some negative implications of some of the technologies
Instagram, could be Twitter, Facebook, when we think about cyberbullying and just access and adolescence, which are two volatile things that come together. But we don't have places where we're really, I shouldn't say we don't, but I think we really need to have places where we need to model this wisdom of how to be online and how to be in spaces. So I think we, with technology, that it could be a benefit, but we also need to think about the ethics of technology.
And how should teachers be supported by schools to master those technological tools? Because in order to do what you're saying needs to be done, you really need to know the ins and outs of all of that stuff.
We need to embrace failure. We cannot allow people to experiment and then punish them and crush them because they've allowed these things open. It should be a learning experience. And I understand there's COPPA and there's laws, but at the same time, in order to do it, you have to experiment. And sometimes you get it wrong. You get it wrong in that the tool is not really useful for it, or you get it wrong because it's not really effective. But I really think we need to leave space. And as Linda said, and I think it's a critical point, have we designed our systems so that we allow for this kind of exploration? There's no way a teacher is going to master all the tools. I mean, I dedicate a lot of time. That's because I'm single. and I have a cat. But sorry, I overshared. But, I mean, I could look at all these things. However, I don't think – there's no way. There's so many tools, both software and hardware, to be able to explore. I think you have to leave space.
That's where I think equity – of opportunity is very, very important to acknowledge, because many schools do not have even the infrastructure to have the appropriate technologies. And we know that technology can be a tool to really personalize learning. And what Dr. McConaughey talked about, all those different differentiated instruction that's happening in the classroom, it takes the burden away from the teacher and allows all that busy work and allows the teacher to actually teach while others are individualizing what a student needs to take them from where they are to where they need to be. The other thing we have to remember about technology, it is a wonderful tool to connect us with experts. The best teacher in the classroom cannot have all of the content knowledge that they need. But technology allows them to connect with others, both content as well as application, whether it's the workforce or others who can make that content real to that student.
Dr. McConaughey.
Two thoughts. First of all, I think part of the problem is that in education, technology has become synonymous with computers, and that's not necessarily the case. Our children are exposed to computers, but technology up until second grade is basically what I would have had as a more of a physical science curriculum, electronic circuitry, learning about motion, about sound by building paper cup robots. They go into computers when they also have the dexterity to start doing keyboard, so we don't create a lot of two-finger typists. So it's a situation that I think also technology needs to be looked as a tool to enhance or extend an educational goal that you already had. So Michelle uses it to teach a course that she would have taught anyway, but she uses it in a different way. And I think in a lot of schools, technology has become a standalone course where it's completely separated from the contract, from the instructional technique, and I think that's wrong.
Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Dr. Sarah Scott, and I'm the founder of an organization called Open Literacy, which focuses on improving literacy instruction in pre-K through fifth grade classrooms. My question is about early childhood education. Recently, there's been considerable national and local attention to the importance of early childhood education. Can you speak to the current state of early childhood in the city and where you think we should head so that we have a robust pre-K through 12th grade pipeline? Specifically, it would be really helpful if you could speak to what you perceive as the barriers to a world-class early childhood education for our youngest learners.
Patrick Dowd.
So a couple things. First of all, I think we've seen a tremendous, you're right, there's a tremendous amount of attention that's given to early childhood, and rightly so. There's a lot of research that tells us it's a really important area with a lot of great success and more to come. If we look across the Commonwealth, we know that there are, I forget the exact numbers, but there are large numbers of children who have no access or limited access to early childhood programming, and that is something that we need to look at very carefully here in the region. I know Dr. Hippert and the AIU spend a lot of time focusing on that. The Pittsburgh Public Schools have spent a lot of time on that. But there is still an awful lot of work to be done on that. One thing that's really interesting, thinking about this discussion this evening, early childhood in many ways might be sort of a glimpse into the future. Here's a network, take our region, take our Commonwealth, here's an area where there is a network of a variety of providers, all sorts of different folks providing high quality, in many cases, programming to young children, associated with religious institutions, independent, public, private, etc., all of whom are trying to meet certain state standards and beyond. And so I think that's really something for us to think about. How can we take that model of a multiplicity of providers, have a common set of standards and a common set of objectives, and really try to drive some change for a system? Because it's working there. We see it every day.
Dr. Welch?
I would think that we also can't forget that there is an opportunity gap, even in pre-K. We have children who come to school who have no food. We have children who come out of homes where parents are struggling to make a living and to provide a roof. We have children who are homeless. I think we have to think about pre-K education as a community-wide issue, and who has what kind of access, not just to the content, not just to the physical space, not even just to great teachers, but who is locked out because there really is an access gap. There really is a gap around wraparound services and mental health services. So I think we have to think about the child holistically. What do we need to be providing that makes for a robust pre-K experience?
And I might follow up with that, Dr. Welch, by asking you, how do we help build a sense of self-esteem and having success so that that can be carried into the future by any particular child?
Well, I think that we have to build safe learning environments for children. We have to take into account all of the things I've said and all of the things that my colleagues have talked about. But I also think we have to value pre-K education. I'm not just talk about it, but put the kind of resources into it so that no child is locked out of that opportunity. And I think we can talk about it all we want, but if we don't, what we do is we invest in what we care about. So if we care about our children, we will invest straight through from the time that they're little all the way up through high school, and we'll make sure that all the children have the opportunity to have the access to the best that we can give.
And we know that in our county, 40% of our pre-K age children are not enrolled in a high quality preschool education program. And we work very hard going door to door trying to encourage parents to enroll their children in a preschool program in the county.
Thank you, Dr. Hippert. And let's go to our audience. We have one of the student members of our audience. So go ahead and say your name and what school you're from and ask your question.
My name is Nate, and I am a student at Colfax School, and I am part of the Greeny Academy First Lego League Robotics Club, and I have a question, and my question is directed to Dr. Wendell McConaugh, and I'm just going to ask, how do you see robotics for language arts and in other different classes?
Well, actually, Nate, and our school because you're very close to us physically, and we also have the robotics clubs, and I'm sure you guys have been in some of the same contests together. Our robotics is set up as an after-school program, but also something that happens during the day. So our teachers start the program, but then it's carried on by parents at the club level in the evening. And we do the same sort of competitions that you're involved in. I think that once you get the basic ideas of robotics and how to do the programming, and I know you move from one level to another level based on the sophistication of the programming, I think the part that's missing, and we're just starting to do it now, is then taking it, now how does it go back into the rest of the classroom? And in the example that I gave, it's a situation where we're trying to use robotics to teach writing. because, as I said, the same sort of instructions you have to give that robot to program it to go out, do a particular activity, turn around, kick a ball, whatever it may be, is the same sort of instructions you have to give a reader that's trying to read a story that you've just written. So we're starting to use robotics in a variety of different classes, not just science. We're also incorporating it into art. We're incorporating it into language arts. We're incorporating it into math, where you can actually do calculations in advance of what you're going to program the robot to do. So I think it's one of those technologies, as Michelle was talking about, that is underutilized at this point, but I think it's going to be a much bigger part. I think you'll be doing robotics all day soon.
And you're listening to a special WESA Life of Learning Community Forum on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guests, Dr. Wendell McConaughey, director of the Falk Laboratory School at Pitt, Michelle King, teacher at the Environmental Charter School, Patrick Dowd, executive director of Allies for Children, Dr. Olga Welch, dean of the School of Education at Duquesne, and Dr. Linda Hippert, executive director of the Allegheny Intermediate Unit. Let's go back out to our audience for a question.
Hi, my name is Shamira Williams. I'm the owner of TechStar. I am one of those child care providers, and I want to know, how are you trying to bring us into the fold? I've taught preschool, and now I run an after-school program, and we're STEM-based. I wish I can get a first Lego team. I'm dying for somebody to provide me with first Lego, but I don't have access to it, and I don't have the funds for it because early childhood doesn't pay that much, and there is an access gap in an opportunity gap. I'm in the Homewood area, so we don't have all those resources. If my parents can't pay their copay from child care subsidy, they either lose funding, lose the opportunity, and their kids lose out. So if I don't say, you know what, I'll eat the cost, they're out of that experience. We happen to be able to offer our students access to iPads and netbooks, and I do STEM-based stuff and robotics and things like that, but I don't have all the resources. So how are we bringing collaboration for all of us to come together? Because early childhood isn't technically at the table right now, nor is after school.
Michelle King?
I think we have to look at learning as an ecology, that we are connected from pre-K learning, early learning, childhood learning, to elementary school, middle school, high school, to universities. So we have stuff like the Create Lab that's doing really interesting work with robotics, and they're trying to push that out at low cost. We really, through Pitt and Duquesne, we really need to think of ourselves as, how are we interconnected as systems? And that we can't let some part of the system fail, because that has implications for so much else, right? If at the very beginning we don't have kids loving learning, if at the very beginning kids come into our system seeing themselves as deficits, we have done wrong as a community of learners. And I think we have to, you know, we have the Kids in Creativity Network that has been growing over time, and that's looking at, that's over 100 organizations, private schools, public schools, universities, AIU, after-school, in-school programs, and really looking at a connection and thinking about Pittsburgh. We have the Hive Network now. And so I think the beginning, really kind of pushing this ecology, ecological system of learning.
So Patrick Dowd?
In the county, we work with our child care providers in Allegheny County. And when I refer to Allegheny County, unfortunately, I'm really talking about the 42 districts that surround the county, and then Pittsburgh Public is its own. And so we do work with the child care providers in order to supply standards, talk about ideas, creativity, things that are happening in all of their programs, and partner with them, because our goal, obviously, is to have the highest quality of pre-K in all of the areas, not just the ones that we are operating.
The same would be true inside of the city, not necessarily with the AIU 3, but with the city schools. I would also say that, you know, to your point, I mean, I think one of the things that we have to think about as a community and as a commonwealth is, how are we going to actually make sure that we provide the funding that's necessary to make sure that all children actually have access to high-quality pre-K programming? And I think there is a campaign that's currently underway, Pre-K for PA, Michelle Figlar and Pacey and a number of other folks from across the state who are really pushing that as a priority. And I think that that's something that we need to focus on and be supportive of.
Dr. McConaughey.
Yeah, I think also there's oftentimes a reluctance for collaboration between private and public. Michelle is at a public school. We're at a private school. We've worked together over the last 4 years. Since Environmental Charter started, we've been collaborative partners with that. You have universities that would love to have a better outreach to the community that sometimes don't know how to make those connections. I would be very happy to sit down with you afterwards and say, is there anything that we could do? As a laboratory school, if we develop program or we develop connections and we don't disseminate them to the larger community, we failed in our mission. So part of what we're expected to do is work on program, work on collaborations, and then take them to the larger community. So, and oftentimes it's a case that neither side is asked, and it might be as simple as that, at least for a start.
Another area that I wanted to touch on before we wrap up is that I understand Pittsburgh and the Pittsburgh area is a leader in STEAM, making sure that the arts are included along with the STEM components. What are some of the new, exciting, and creative ways that you are looking to teach STEAM and encouraging more young women to embrace these subject areas?
So,
Dr. Hippert.
Due to the graciousness of the Benedum and the Grable Foundations, our schools in the county over the past 3 years have received close to $2 million in grants to implement STEAM programs into their schools. So there are programs happening throughout the county, from gaming, as you heard Michelle talk about some of those, to new media that is occurring in the libraries, to innovative after-school programs that are taking place that incorporate science, technology, engineering, the arts, and mathematics. And they are also include partnerships with many of either after-school providers or, in some cases, experts from the field, colleges and universities, et cetera, to bring programs throughout the county. And we are in the process right now of putting together a list of best practices that are occurring. So not only schools here can learn from each other, but teachers can learn from each other as to what they might want to bring into their classrooms. And I know Michelle is very familiar and has done many things as well to help others to bring the STEM programs into the classrooms.
I like to say there's a silent H in STEAM for history. Where's the love, brothers
why
and
not?
Sister? Yes.
Why not the history?
But yeah, the social sciences have to be in there as well. I mean, they have to understand the complexity. The social sciences wrap all those things together.
Dr. Welch.
I think we have wonderful models, as my colleagues have talked about. There are many models. We have to have a mindset that says that the arts, that history, are important enough for us to invest in our schools and to get our children to see the connections between. Because when we listen to the dialogues about education, it's all about STEM. It's all about, I don't hear about arts. I don't hear the music. I don't hear the connections being made with the social sciences as much as I would like to hear as part of the public discourse around education. So an ecological model says that, in fact, we're educating the whole child and we're talking about all of the subject areas, just as the gentleman spoke about earlier, the connection between anthropology and philosophy. I think we have to make those connections in the educational experiences of children, and we have to value it enough to invest in it.
Have any of you on the panel heard of the study that they did or what they were doing in Finland, which has been studied, and that is introducing young children to music, to teaching them to play instruments, and that that makes them better at learning and comprehending math concepts later on in school?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And they're also not covering as much. I mean, we have the fill the shopping cart and, like, get everything. I mean, their curriculum is they're not covering as much material, not spending as much time. I mean, just day in, day out of in the classroom. And I think there's also a blending of things. I think you also have a teacher staying with students at a younger age. So I'm in the environmental charter school. I'll loop with kids, so I have 7th and 8th graders. So you get that whole child piece. I mean, one of the things as an educator you lose is that every time you meet them the first time. And so having something where you're staying with children and you're understanding them as a learner, as a whole child, as a whole being, is critical. And then also some of the courses we have, like cultural literacy, which is a blend of social sciences and English. We have a blending, our labs, where we have a blending of science and arts that by design are forcing those connect, not forcing, but really seeing those connections.
Fascinating. I wish we had more time. We're going to take one more question from the audience. Go ahead.
My name is Shannon Marenstein. I'm also from the Environmental Charter School. My question is, we can't hope to have a vibrant and thriving city without a world-class, progressive, and forward-thinking public school system. How might we shift our perspective to view schools as catalysts for innovation in our communities? And more broadly, how might we create a collaborative and equitable relationship between innovative public charter schools that are incubating these best practices right now and our larger public school system?
So I recently provided some testimony in regard to charter schools, and I think it's really important that the barrier that exists right now is funding. And it seems to be that's the competition that exists because of the lack of an appropriate method of funding for charter schools, because they were designed to be these incubators for innovation and to be able to do things that the traditional public school is not able to do for a variety of reasons or hasn't been able to do. So I think we need the help of legislators to overcome that, so that we can create this new vision for education, not just in the Pittsburgh region, but across the Commonwealth, so that we can get back to, for example, charters, what they were intended to do, and assuring that they are doing that and that we can learn from that. I think as far as innovation, the region, as we heard, is off to a very, very good start because there is an emphasis on creativity and innovation. The Kids in Creativity movement, which is made up of not only educators, but a variety of people from technology throughout our region, are coming together to find ways to improve education for children in our schools, to get them engaged, to make them more interested in learning many of the things that we talked about here tonight.
I have two final questions for the panel. The first, what role does government need to play at the local, state, or federal level to help transform education? Or is it up to the stakeholders closest to the students, the educators, the parents, the community organizations, the students as well, to lead the way and maybe drag along, nudge the lawmakers to whatever action might be needed?
So a couple things.
Patrick,
I think, first of all, just back to the charter question, I actually think to some extent the region's off to a good start as far as its relationship. I think there are these issues that Dr. Hibbert points out that are very important and have to get resolved. But if you look at the charter schools, for example, inside of the city, we have a number of them that are actually truly innovative programs. They are different from what's offered in the public system, the traditional system. And the public schools do recognize, the Pittsburgh Board of Education does recognize the charters as true public schools inside of their own system by saying, look, any graduate of a charter high school is eligible for the Pittsburgh Promise in the same way that somebody from you know, Westinghouse or Obama or Kappa is. So I think there's the foundation for this solid relationship. It just has to, these barriers and roadblocks have to be eliminated. As second is thinking about the role of government, I'll just throw this out just to be provocative, but I think down the road we need to think about the Board of Education, for example, at the locality, as having a slightly different role. Currently we think of it as owning facilities, owning assets and liabilities, and dealing with the system in that particular way. Could we imagine a Board of Ed that is really, it's not responsible for ownership as much as it is responsible for accreditation and for this setting the standards or maintaining the standards that we have here in Pennsylvania, and guaranteeing that the charter schools, traditional public schools as we understand them, and other schools that may not yet be created performing, and to make sure that every child in the city has access and where necessary to make sure that we're creating those programs. I think that we do need local leadership at the board level, and I think clearly we need to have some changes at the state level to think about how we're actually funding this system. You know, there's too much reliance in Pennsylvania on property taxes at the local level to fund public education, which creates many of the gaps that we've been talking about today. When you have localities that are required to put more money in because the state's putting less for reasons that aren't necessarily evil or wrong, they have their own funding issues. But until we figure out how to redesign the way that we fund this system, we're going to have some troubles, and we're going to continue to have these gaps. So I would say at the local level, we need leadership and sort of innovation as to how we think about education in the future and how we think of the governance of education. I think we need that leadership coupled with community partners and community members to think about how we advocate for changing the way that we fund public education at the state level.
Dr. McConaughey.
Given your choice of A or B, I would go with B. I think that for whatever reason, federal and state legislators decided that schools were not succeeding. And their response was to mandate a longer school day and a longer school year. And I was always perplexed by the fact that if you're not doing things well, but if you did it longer, it would be better. And I'm a little concerned about that. I truly believe that schools have to be changed from within, and that the place to start is with the teachers and administrators at the local level. I don't think it can change by mandate from outside.
Last question. From the suggestions and input we've received at this forum, it seems like the Pittsburgh region has the vision to transform education, but do we have the will to do it? Not just a school here and there, but doing it and leaving them to do it on their own, but all partners on board, educators, service groups, parents, organizations, including our libraries, employers, in a unified approach for the educational success of our children. And I'll start with Dr. Welch.
I think that is the central question. I think we do know how to do this. We always have known how to do it. The will question is, what are we willing to do as a community and as community stakeholders to make sure that all the children receive the education we think they should? So I would say that to your previous question, it is both a bottom-up and a top-down meeting. And how do we do that? How do we create the conversations? How do we create the opportunities to share best practices across? And how do we look at funding that is realistic and make sure that that realistic funding is targeted to the areas that we as a community have identified need to be in order to assure the educational opportunities we're looking for?
And we'll go right down the panel. Dr. McConaughey.
Yeah, I think the will is there, and I think I agree that we know how to do it. We're reluctant to make substantial changes to a current system. Excuse me, no one likes change. And we've sort of tried to tweak the outside edges without actually changing the whole format. And we've talked today about radically different ways of educating students. And I think, as you say, if the will is there, it can happen. We know how to do it, but we need to get everybody moving in the same direction.
Michelle King.
I think we need to begin to look at different ways of measurement and connecting us to what really matters. I think when we begin to see connections like air quality, right, in some places, food deserts, lack of access to certain resources, when we begin to see the complexity of our city, then I think we begin to act differently about the health and well-being of all our citizens, particularly of our young people. They will inherit our city to lead. And what will we leave them? Will we lead them with the directions and the passions and desires to do what's best? Or will we leave them with to act individually, to act without concern, and to only do right by themselves? And so really it's upon us to leave our children a legacy, whether they're in school or not in school or they're way beyond school, to really take responsibility for the well-being of the community that they live in.
Dr. Linda Hippert?
So first of all, I do think that we have a great opportunity in our Pittsburgh region. I think we have support, financial support, from many of our foundations who will support creativity and innovation. I also think we have a small enough but large enough community that knows each other, and we know the players. And whether it's at the university level, at the business level, we are working together. The challenge that I heard you say, Paul, is the unified approach. I don't think there is just one approach. Instead, I think we have to identify our goals. What is it we're trying to achieve? And tap into the wonderful intelligence and resources that we have to say, here are the different ways we will get there, because children are different, educators are different, communities are different. But if we come together and set those goals, we really can achieve that and make our region one that others will want to model. So I'm certainly very proud to be part of that community and to work with others to make that happen.
And Patrick Dowd.
So I'm going to sort of come back to what I said earlier. I think there are two things happening at the same time. There's a system as we know it, right? There's the public system and all the education institutions as we know them. And we're working to improve those systems for the children and youth who are in them now. But if you look, and a number of things have been mentioned here, if you look across the region and see what's happening, whether it's in early childhood programming, after school, kids and creativity, I mean, we could start to look and see all the different areas where we're essentially modeling and testing and learning what these new opportunities and new systems perhaps might even look like at some point. So I think you see a chance to maintain and improve what exists, while at the same time we're essentially building and revolutionizing education a piece at a time. The will does exist, and I would also say this. At first, I think because of all those little tests, we can say, yeah, there is a will. But I also think that there are crises on the horizon. We have districts that are deeply challenged. We have communities that are struggling to provide for their children and their youth, and we have all sorts of issues in that front that we're going to have to address very squarely in the coming years. And so I think we have opportunity, and we see chances to improve, but we also know we're going to have to put that into practice in the coming months and years.
And that will conclude this 90.5 WESA Life of Learning Community Forum. This forum will be archived at our website, WESA.FM. Thanks to our panelists, Patrick Dowd, Executive Director of Allies for Children, Dr. Linda Hippert, Executive Director of the Allegheny Intermediate Unit, Michelle King, teacher at the Environmental Charter School, Wendell McConaughey, director of the Falk Laboratory School, and Olga Welch, dean of the School of Education at Duquesne University. And thanks to our audience for this forum at the Community Broadcast Center. Our director of engineering is Russ Lloyd. Production assistance from Michael Lynch and Katie Blackley. Marketing assistance from Maddie Knapp. Our senior news editor is Mark Newtbar, and director of content is Tammy Turwell. Executive producer for Special News Projects, Kevin Gavin. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for joining us. This is 90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR news station.